listening to Truth To You with Jono, and g'day to Darren Chan, who commented saying, another great teaching from Yoel. That was on last week's program. And wherever you may be around the world, it is good to have your company. It is, of course, time for Light of the Prophets with Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, Yoel.
G'day, you too.
Hey, how you going?
Well, the count is over.
The count is over. Just to let everyone know, of course, we do record some of these from time to time in advance. And today is the day after Shavuot, right?
Yes, it is. It's the day after Shavuot.
I'll tell you what. I am stuffed full of food. I am so stuffed full of food. I'm enormously full of food.
Well, we had something very interesting. I mean, we had a whole bunch of stuff, and we also had what's called a pomegranate wine, which is very, very nice. The kind we tried was really, really good.
Wow.
It was smooth. It wasn't intense like some of the pomegranate wines I've tried.
I've never tried a pomegranate wine. Is it? So it's all right. Is it similar to your conventional wine or?
Yes and no. I mean, it's not. It doesn't have, for example, the cut. It's red, so it doesn't really have the tanning that you have in regular wine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really a liqueur. It's not, you know, it's not like liquor or anything like that. It's actually a lot smoother, and it's not as harsh. I mean, it has a relatively high percentage of alcohol like wine, but it's not as, you know, the one we had wasn't as harsh as some have tasted, and it doesn't have that sometimes punch in the face sensation that you get from wine. You can actually drink it, but the thing is, it's really more like a dessert wine.
Oh,
so
like a port or something like that.
No, not as heavy as a port, but it's kind of a dessert wine because it's sweet. Because it is made from pomegranates, and the point is to actually preserve the flavor of the pomegranates as well. And part of the flavor of pomegranates, good pomegranates, actually is also sweet. Wine, on the other hand, you're trying to get more the aroma, less the sweetness. I actually want the alcohol, you know, to eat away the sugar.
So,
but here you're actually trying to preserve some of the sugar, so you're trying to preserve some of the sweetness as well.
Is that a typical thing that you would treat yourself with on Shavuot?
Well, not necessarily, no. My point with it was that there's actually an entry in the Talmud that speaks about pomegranate wine and strawberry wine. Really what it means is they have some types of liqueur.
Uh-huh.
So, people have been starting to remake these things the past couple of years. I mean, we have lots of pomegranates here in Israel. And pomegranate happens to be one of my favorite fruits.
Nice.
And one of the things is that someone read in the Talmud that speaks about this type of wine. They said, okay, let's try to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been seeing these types of, we're going to call them quote unquote wine, all over the place now. But there's different types, and there have been darker ones or lighter ones. And for example, there's even for blackberry wine of sorts, mm-hmm. that actually my wife's father was the one who taught the guy who was the first person. My wife's father had this recipe of how to make it, and he has a friend that opened up a winery, and he taught him how to make it. So now there's actually the wineries of Gush Etzion,
mm-hmm.
Which is in Judea, produce a blackberry wine of sorts, which is based on my wife's father's recipe.
Really? Nice.
And it's extremely good, and it's not cheap. That's the thing. This is a very, very good recipe. Every time I speak to my father-in-law, he says to me, you know, I'm actually proud of the fact that I've enabled someone to learn something that most people don't know how to make here in Israel.
Yeah.
It's actually in Judea, and it's been sold, but only produced by Jews in Judea, and it's really, really, really good. It's really nice.
Wow.
So they actually, you'd be surprised. A lot of, you know, I posted this whole thing about thanking God for the land and everything. You should understand something. Israeli wine, I mean, if you get really good Israeli wine, it's actually extremely good. Now, putting that aside, because Israeli wine gets has a good name around the world, but it's not like, mm-hmm. the French wines and everything. But I'm saying these wines are actually very, very good. And we have very good soil here for winemaking. And we have very, very good varieties of grapes here in Israel. Obviously, we don't have all the varieties. I mean, there's types that we don't have here. But slowly, slowly, it's coming in. And we have wineries from all over Israel. And the wines are extremely good. I mean, there are junky wines out there. I do know. But the fact remains that there are some really, really good wines.
Mm.
And really, the rule with food and wine itself is whatever you like is what's best. Not, you know, for example, someone once gave me a taste out of a bottle that was worth like hundreds of shekels. No, hundreds of dollars, sorry. And I sneered at it. And he says, well, this is really expensive wine. And I said, listen, the fact that it's produced by so-and-so doesn't mean it's good. You know, it's what you like is what is important here.
Mm.
So, no, it's pretty amazing what goes on here in Israel. I mean, the fact that I've heard stories, and I learned this in the history of Zionism, and I've seen pictures and everything, and this place was desolate. I mean, really, there was nothing growing here except for certain areas where there were woods. There were woods that which were thousands of years old.
Mm-hmm.
Besides those places, there was really most of the area was desolate.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the story from Mark Twain. Remember this.
That's right.
This person who came up to me and said to me, "Oh, Mark Twain was a drunk and everything." And I said, "That's your excuse." The fact remains that I've actually seen pictures, and I actually spoke with people who were here back in the 1920s and told me what was going on here.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing what's happened here in Israel. And this is why
it produces these days. It's flourishing. And just the thought of, I mean, here I will say we had we cracked open a bottle of organic wine given to us by friends of yours, Mark and Izumi.
Oh, wow, what a couple.
Lovely people, and g'day to them. She's from Japan, of course, and he's from here in Australia, and they came and visited you
they came to Israel for looking for the Aviv and came for a whole visit and everything, and we just started talking. It was pretty amazing. I've learned one very interesting thing: always be open-minded, because you'll be surprised who you meet. And yeah, so if they're hearing this, I miss you guys.
They were really, really nice. They came and dropped in, and we had a great chat, and they gave us this bottle of wine which we had over Shavuot, which was a beautiful thing. And we're also very blessed here to be living right next door to a vineyard which our landlord owns, and he does give us of his wine from time to time. It's very, very good. But I've never had pomegranate wine. I've never had blackberry wine. I've never had strawberry wine, and it really got me curious. When I come to Israel, we're going to sample some of this stuff.
I'll take you on a tour if you want.
Excellent. Wine tours with Yoel Ben Shlomo. I like it. Okay. Now, that's not what we're doing today, though. Today we're doing – before we get into it, I do want to say, and I know I speak for you, thank you to the anonymous listener who contributed a very generous amount of money towards your plane ticket and expenses to getting over to the States to see your father who isn't well. We just want to take the opportunity to say thank you. So they know who they are, and they truly are a blessing.
Yes, they know who they are, and I don't know who you are. We're going to keep it anonymous, but thank you very, very much. I am actually very deeply touched by it, and everyone out there, you're awesome. I mean, also the feedback that I get from people on the Facebook page is very, very good. Mm. And by the way, we've passed the 400 mark.
That's right. 400. That happened
last night, and I actually want I thanked this person who was the 400th person on Hebrew in Israel. But let me pull out their name again just to say thank you live.
Mm-hmm.
And this person was Philip Samuels Gullivan.
Good on you, Philip.
And I said thank you, Philip Samuel Gullivan, for being the 400th person. To like this page, and he actually said "bevakasha," which means "you're welcome" in Hebrew.
Excellent.
So I'm very, very happy. And Joshua Anthony Rivera, I don't know what number you are. I'll look it up and I'll tell you. I'm not too sure I'm able to know. By the way, because it doesn't give me a number who you are. It just gives me that you're there. So
and that is the Facebook page. That is the Facebook page of Hebrew in Israel, and you can get there by clicking on the link in the right-hand sidebar of the website, truth2u.org, truth2u.org. And if anybody else, any other listeners that are out there who would like to contribute back to Yoel, a little something, and just while he's getting all these finances together to get over to see his father who's not well, who he hasn't seen in 2.5 years, who lives in the States, you can certainly, if you like, you can send it to me, you can send me an email, or you can put a note in with the donation by clicking on the donation page and doing that there. We certainly do appreciate that. And thank you, guys. I mean, you guys are great. You're a great audience, excellent listeners. I love my listeners. We better jump into it. What do you reckon?
And don't forget to donate for Truth to You. It's an awesome job. Trying to bring us the most amazing people like Nehemiah and Keith and Coulter Carrot. I actually know her personally. Not personally. I know who she is. I never met her. But people, help Jono get this thing out.
Thank you, my friend. Now, we're kicking off from chapter 22, and we're going to finish it off, I think. We're going to finish off.
Yes, I think we're going to try to finish this one off. I mean, again, the Book of Joshua is relatively simple because there are not too many storylines.
Mm-hmm.
And the only problem really we have with the Book of Joshua, at least as far as I see it, is it's a historical book, and it has a lot of documentation as well. Also, I want to go back for a moment to this whole issue with the cities. Why all the cities mentioned? I think all the cities are mentioned because they're signing some kind of an agreement here. This is what you receive as your property. I mean, for example, like a deed on your property. So it gives you the borders of what each tribe is. Mm-hmm. And then from that, there's also cities that Levites and priests are supposed to receive. So this is a document that says, okay, if anyone has any arguments regarding who owns what, we go back to the Book of Joshua. It's basically a deed to the land, which is kind of interesting.
That's a really good point.
Yeah, so it's a deed to the land, and that's how I see these chapters, and this is why it does this. So, for example, you go to the Book of Chronicles, it gives you all these genealogies and everything, because they're returning after the exile, and they want to make sure that people know who's who and who's what.
Makes sense.
Because, for example, like Nehemiah pointed out, this is the whole thing of the people who it might be priests, but they don't know. So he tells them, you know, they can't show their genealogy, but they mentioned their names so there'll be no confusion. Now, I'm bringing that up also just for a moment because I've been receiving a few messages here and there, and I spoke with people who believe that they're descendants of different tribes and things like that. And as I keep on telling people, a lot of people's genealogy has been lost now. You might be a descendant of a certain tribe. You might be a descendant of a family or priests of Kohanim. But I do put a warning there. Again, like I said last time, is do not act on it. If you have proof that you're descendant of a Cohen family through genealogy, I mean, you took a person to research your family, etc., and you come up with this thing, that is something which is acceptable. I've actually know of cases of people, for example, Jews, who never knew they were from a priestly family, and then they checked through the genealogy and discovered that their paternal ancestors were actually the Kohanim. It was lost because someone became secular, whatever. That can work. But family names are not enough.
Mm-hmm.
Having some kind of a hunch is not enough. Even the genetic testing is not enough. But if you discover, if you, for example, discover that you have a gene that says you that you might be some kind of belong to some kind of a group inside the Levite gene pool or the priestly gene pool, then what you should do the next stage is to do the genealogy checking.
Sure.
And by the way, also to women, it doesn't really matter what your genealogy is. And I'm sorry I'm saying this, but it doesn't really matter what your genealogy is. Really, the moment you get married, you belong to your husband's genealogy. But on the other hand, being a descendant of the house of Israel is a completely different concept.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even if you're a descendant, say for example, of a Levite family, a priestly family, it has no real function. It just because women didn't serve in the temple. But on the other hand, there are certain rules regarding a woman who is a descendant of the house of Aaron. There are rules that they have to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
So there are things here and there, and it's a bit more complex. But when it comes to deciding what you are and what tribe, because I've been receiving messages, private messages from people as well, emails. Mm-hmm. I've been speaking with people that I meet every once in a while, and everyone's convinced that there's probably some descent of some tribe and everything. And I brought this up already in the past as well. And what I'm saying is, you might be, but even if you're not, don't let that discourage you. Because as it says in Isaiah 56, the Gentiles who decide to join up with the God of Israel, it doesn't matter. It really, really doesn't matter. If you are or if you're not, the moment you decide you're in covenant with the God of Israel, that's really what counts. Mm-hmm. And if you're a descendant of the house of Israel, that's even better. But don't be discouraged, you know, and don't try to force yourself into things.
Amen.
Flow with it. Be happy with it. Be happy that you're discovering these things. Be happy that you're discovering people who can teach you and things that you can learn by yourself. And just try to do good in the world. And as Kohelet says, you know, in the end, everything is just fear God and do His will. And doing His will is also doing good in the world. And that's really
Amen.
It's been coming up a lot lately, so I'm just
sure. Well, then it's probably worth mentioning once again. It is Ezra chapter 2, verse 63, that points out that if you're not absolutely certain, if you don't have all the details of your background, you think maybe there's a Levitical or a Cohen link there, but you don't have all the details, you're not entirely sure. According to this verse, it's best to wait for the high priest and the Urim and the Thummim before you act upon that. But again, as Yoel says, don't let it discourage you. So this is how it begins, my friend. It says, "Then Joshua called the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh and said to them, you have..." Now this is interesting, Yoel, because in the tradition that I came from, this just isn't possible. Joshua said to them, "You have kept all that Moses, the servant of Yehovah, commanded you, and you have obeyed my voice in all that I have commanded you. You have not left your brethren these many days up to this day, but have kept the charge of the commandments of Yehovah your Elohim. And now Yehovah your Elohim has given rest to your brethren as he promised. Now therefore return and go to your tents and to the land of your possession, which Moses, the servant of Yehovah, gave you on the other side of the Jordan. But take careful heed." Now what he's saying, Yoel, correct me if I'm wrong, but he's saying, "Hey, you guys have passed. You've done what you've done everything you're supposed to do."
That's exactly what he's saying. Also, there's interesting here, because when you read it, he's also repeating the words of Moses himself.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, this entire section, chapters 22, 23, 24, there's a lot of repetitive language from the book of Deuteronomy, from what Moses is saying. So again, we see the reflection of Moses also in Joshua. Like, remember, we started with something a few weeks ago, now we're going back into it.
Mm-hmm.
Joshua is talking to them in the same language that Moses spoke with them, and he's actually telling them, "Okay, you've done it. You know, you get 100% on this one."
Yeah.
And now he's telling them, "Okay, you fulfilled your part of the bargain. Now go back to your homes." And you have to remember, these people were probably battling for quite a while. And they probably went to the families every once in a while to say hello, to visit and everything. But he's basically telling them, "You did it. You know, you've fulfilled what you promised."
Yeah. And so he says, "So take careful heed to do the commandments and the law which Moses, the servant of Yehovah, commanded you, to love Yehovah your Elohim, to walk in his ways, to keep his commandments, to hold fast to him." Hold fast. Is that Davak?
Dovka, but yeah, Davak is to cling.
Okay.
It's from the word devik, which means glue. So where something is devik, here it's dovka, because of the few changes that happened in the word. But it's from the word devik, which means to cling or to glue. Today in modern Hebrew we say devik, which means... actually, there's a verse that says, "V'amela devik tov," when it says to the glue that it's good. So yeah, it basically means to cling to something, but powerfully cling to it.
So you could say literally to glue yourself to God, right?
Exactly.
Nice. "And to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul." So Joshua blessed them and sent them away, and they went to their tents. Now, to half the tribe of... Yeah?
By the way, there's a very, very important thing, because the last thing, this warning he gives them, is linked to the next thing that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay? It's when you learn the narrative of stories, specifically in the Bible, a lot of things, they start off with something as if it's not related, and then it leads into something else, which is very, very, is really the point of the next section.
And almost takes you by surprise, really, doesn't it?
Well, it takes you by surprise, yes. But when you analyze text, you start realizing, okay, this is actually, they're leading us here into this. And this has to do with the entire Bible. I'm going to say this really, really bluntly. It has to do with the entire Bible. There's editing in the Bible itself. And I'm not talking about the type of editing that we're talking, you know, like, for example, Wilhausen or the multiple author theory people say, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to remember, someone actually sat down and wrote the story, wrote what happened. And let's take out the five books of Moses, but when we take everything from Joshua all the way to the end, we have to remember, someone sat down and wrote all of this, and if anyone has ever written a book, I mean, for example, Nehemiah is writing his book, and by the way, it's an awesome book. When it comes out, buy it.
Incredible book.
I mean, I read English, but it's a bit slower than what I read Hebrew. I couldn't put this thing down. I was done in just a few hours, which is extremely unusual for me, and it was fascinating. The book is just excellent. So when it comes out, people, it's something to wait for.
Yeah, oh yeah.
But I've been talking with Nehemiah. He's been writing this book for quite a while, and he's been telling me about the turmoils of writing a book. and the backwards and going backwards and forwards time on things and re-editing and stuff like that. So yes, whoever wrote, for example, the Book of Joshua did some kind of editing. And it unlike the Torah, I mean, for example, we believe the Torah was dictated to Moses.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of the books, I mean, someone actually sat down and wrote them. People sat down and wrote them. And there must have been editing also throughout the centuries. I mean, I don't know 100%, but for example, in the Book of Proverbs, it says that, it says in chapter 25 that these are also proverbs that King Hezekiah's court collected and put them down. So it's surprising, yes, but we've been led into it. This is why there's an opening. So when you read a text, I'm just saying there's a lot more to reading the Bible than just reading words.
Sure.
And there's a lot more to reading the Bible than just analyzing words. I mean, I get asked a lot, but I want to learn the roots. That's not everything. There's a lot more going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even syntax. It's not even the issue of studying syntax. Syntax is also very important. But then there's the study of the actual text itself, not focusing on individual words or individual sentences, but then the study of the entire text, which is another stage in studying Bible.
Sure. And so here they are. He sent them back to their tents. He sent them back to their lands. Return with much riches to you. He blessed them, saying, return with much riches to your tents, with very much livestock, with silver and gold, with bronze, with iron, with very much clothing. Divide the spoil of your enemies with your brethren. And
now this is also important, because now they're rich, now they're powerful, now they control the land. And it warns the Book of Deuteronomy, don't let this go to your head. It repeats it several times in the Book of Deuteronomy, the first part of half of the Book of Deuteronomy, where it warns you, you're going to receive houses which you didn't build, you're going to receive riches which you didn't work for, you're receiving fields that you didn't plow. Don't let this corrupt you. Mm-hmm. So we can kind of like feel as if the writer is, and this is my speculation, but the writer is still kind of half treating the two and a half tribes. You're kind of treating them still with suspicion, though the story leads into something else. He's still looking at a bit of suspicion. He's thrown this warning again. And he's saying, don't forget that when you become rich, don't forget who gave it to you. Mm-hmm. And you can feel this hint here when you're reading it.
Because there is the, okay, you guys have done well, you passed, go enjoy, hey, but don't mess it up. But, you know, exactly. Go and be blessed, but don't mess it up, right? And this is the hint that is throughout the first half of 22. But then, Yoel, in verse 10, it says, and when they came to the region of the Jordan, which is in the land of Canaan, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and the half-tribe Manasseh built an altar there by the Jordan, a great impressive altar is what I've got.
Yeah, it says Mizbeach Gadol Lemar'eh. It's just a big altar that can be seen. It's basically a monument.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, you know, because you can build a tiny little altar and sacrifice on it. No, this is a monument. We're trying to make a point here.
Yeah, but you know, this then descends into what is, you know, an international incident almost. You know, this becomes a really really big thing.
International, but it's a national incident.
It's huge, and everybody else, when they hear of it, they think, "Oh my goodness, what have they done?" Verse 12. And when the children of Israel heard of it, the whole congregation of the children of Israel gathered together at Shiloh to go to war against them. Why did they want to go to war against them? What are they thinking?
Okay, this is going to be a bit annoying for some people. But what's going on here is that they think they're building another shrine. Now, what is the whole thing of the shrine here?
Mm-hmm.
It actually goes back to what it says in Deuteronomy, that you will not sacrifice wherever you see fit, but the place that God will choose. Right. Now, what we learn for this is, first of all, something that bashes a lot of the scholars in the teeth is the idea that there is a concept of a centralized religion, a centralized cultic place.
Mm-hmm.
And I say cultic, I'm using the terminology they use, but a center of cultic religion in a very, very early stage of the inhabitants of Israel in the land of Canaan, which basically pushes away the entire theory that there's a disconnection in between the book of Leviticus, the book of Exodus, and the book of Deuteronomy. But they were all given by one author who wrote everything down in conjunction with one another. Mm-hmm. Now, what exactly is the prohibition? The prohibition is that only because God is one God, there should be only one side of worship, and we are not supposed to imitate the worship of the Gentiles who worshipped under every on every mountaintop and under every every fruitful tree, or etzra'anan, which is a lively a tree with livelihood. Now, this is very, very important because, again, we go back into the Book of Deuteronomy. We're going back to a lot of the concepts which were being pushed in the Book of Leviticus, where the Book of Leviticus says very clearly not to sacrifice outside on the field.
Mm-hmm.
So they won't sacrifice. It tells them to bring on all the – actually, in Leviticus, it's saying to bring all your meat, everything, sacrifice and personal consumption to the temple, which means in the tabernacle in the desert, they did not eat meat which wasn't sanctified. But when they enter the land, then they were allowed – it says very clearly in Deuteronomy that prohibition was lifted. Mm-hmm. But we still have the concept of a centralized religion, which also explains why we have later on, unlike, for example, Martin Bobel, who claimed that the prophets were completely disconnected from what the Torah says. No, we see this at a very, very early stage, because the prophets, for example, criticize over and over again the high places, the bamot, which are basically elevated areas where the people would sacrifice outside of the temple wherever they wanted. So we have this concept, literally to begin with, the most, one of some the most early stages of the establishment of the people of Israel in the land of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And this is extremely crucial, this concept here. And again, the other side of it is that also, the moment you start sacrificing somewhere else, it becomes suspicious. Are you sacrificing to some other god? This is why, for example, the Torah has authorities, and there's the authority of the priests and the authority of the Levites, and you have the authority of the king.
Mm-hmm.
And these three authorities, really can put the Levites together with the priests, but really we have the priests in the temple and then the Levites on the Torah, and then you have the king over the nation, and all these three bodies kind of balance out the people. And what we're having here is that we just conquered the land, you're running off to build an altar somewhere else, we have to be suspicious. But they don't immediately attack them. What they do is they send a committee to see to check what the issue is. And then they explain it to
them. And this is before we get to the committee, just to let everyone know, there's Deuteronomy chapter 12 where God says, okay, so if you are slaughtering for your own consumption, you can do it within your gates. But Deuteronomy 16, and particularly in relation to the Passover, he says, no, don't do it in regards to sacrifices to me. You've got to do it here where I put my name.
Exactly.
So there's that. But he sends, the children of Israel send Phinehas. Is that how I pronounce his name?
Phinehas. In English, they call him Phineas. Mm-hmm. The name is really Phinehas.
Phinehas.
Two syllables, Phinehas. And he's actually the grandson of Aaron.
Yeah, and the son of Eleazar.
He's the son of Eleazar, who happens to be the high priest. So some of these characters are still alive. I mean, if you remember, Eleazar became the high priest at the end of 40 years in the desert. Phinehas, we know of him when he appears the first time when Numbers. he kills the Midian girl.
The spear. Well, not just the girl, but the man of Israel as well. What's the word? Shish kebab them together, right?
I don't know if it's not really a shish kebab, because a shish kebab is something else. But anyhow, yeah. So we have him there, and Phinehas. One of the stories about Phinehas is that he was underage when they became the priest, so he was left to be a Levite. And the fact that he did what he did, he showed that he's zealous to God, so he received the gift of becoming a priest as well, become a Kohen as well.
Wow.
Yes, that's one of the stories they say, Briti Shalom, and there's a whole thing of the Vav there is cut off, and a whole bunch of stuff with it, you know, but they say it's a Vav cut off because it was done through violence, but anyhow, the sages say that he was actually a Levite because he was underage. He was underneath the age of 20 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But because of this action, he became a priest. And this is why he's actually acting out now as the son of the high priest. Now, we know in the ancient world, the son of the king, for example, in Jeremiah, appears a couple of times as an important character, as someone who sits in the ministry of the king. Mm-hmm. So here, who's setting up the committee? This is temple things. This has to do with temple service. So who's sending the committee? The people who run the temple.
Yep.
Not really Joshua, but Eleazar, the high priest, and the heads of the tribes. But because it's a temple service issue, then the priests are in charge of it.
Yeah, and so he goes and takes 10 men, heads of the tribes, as you say, and he says, thus says, now I find this really interesting, verse 16, thus says the
You know why 10? There's two issues here with 10.
Okay.
One issue with 10, and I think I'm bombarding you too much, but really issue with 10, there's two things about the number 10. First of all, there's 10 tribes here, mm-hmm. because there's only half of Menashe sitting on the other side of the border, but the real the majority of the part of a really large bulk of tribe of Menashe are actually sitting on the side of the land of Canaan. That's why 10. Also, 10, the number 10 shows up all the time as a group that actually has some kind of an authority, a communion of people. It always appears with the number 10. We have that with Abraham. He reaches number 10 when he talks about Sodom and Gomorrah. He says, up to 10, then he stops. True, we also find the ten spies. So he says, "Admatay la'ida ha'ra'azot." Up to when would you tolerate this evil communion? La'ida as a communion or a group of people that come together. And in Jewish practice, the only way you can have a communal service, for example, a prayer done out loud as a community, is only if you have 10 adult men.
Right.
So number 10 is very, very important as well, with the whole issue of authority and being a community, etc.
Brilliant. No, that makes sense. And so they came to them and they said, thus says the whole congregation of Jehovah, what treachery is this that you have committed against God of Israel? Now their mind is already made up, right? Here we have the accusations that they've committed treachery against the God of Israel. They have turned away this day from following Jehovah, in that you have built for yourselves an altar that you might rebel this day against Jehovah. Is the iniquity of Peor... Now, what? Remind everyone, what happened in Peor?
Well, that's the whole story with Pinchas.
Yes.
Baal Peor, I mean, first of all, the name Baal is the name of a Canaanite god, and it's kind of interesting, the name Baal, something appears left, right, and center.
Mm-hmm.
Peor might be a place. It might be... There's also a theory that says it was some kind of really revolting type of service to that god, which I'm not going to explain here.
Mm-hmm.
If you just look at Baal Peor and rabbinic traditions, you'll find it. I'm not going to explain what is here.
Mm-hmm.
And they're basically saying this was like, you know, we had the golden calf, which was a big no-no, but Baal Peor was the first time the Israelites went and worshipped another god.
Yeah.
The golden calf, they really say, this is your god. You know, they say to him, make something that will go in front of us. So not saying we don't believe in God, they're just, you know.
They wanted something that represented him.
And yeah,
so
exactly.
They made something. It's not as if they were they made a god to represent another god. That was the golden calf. But in this case, it says in Numbers 25.
It was the first time that they actually went and worshipped another god.
That's what it says.
And that was a big, 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 big stain.
And they began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab, and they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and the anger of Jehovah was aroused against Israel.
Exactly. And actually, let me look at that verse, because I'm thinking of something.
That's Numbers chapter 25.
It uses the word nitzmadim, which is... I was speculating the word dovka appears here as well, but no, it's the word nitzmadim, which is to cling to. But the language is pretty interesting. They weren't just going after it; they clinged to Baal Peor, which is even worse.
Oh wow! So okay, I've got joined. You've got clinged,
joined. Well, joined is it's from the word saraf, lehitzaref. Here's from the word samad, which is to put two things one to another where they're really tight to one another.
So this is interesting. Let me get this right, because we spoke before about hold, that what is translated in English is hold fast, which is again was that okay? And now this one in Numbers 25 verse 2 is
nitzmadim. So nitzmadim is from the word semed, which means it can be a couple. Semed from something that you put together and cling to one another. When two, for example, two people are clinging to one another, we say in Hebrew, "Hem nitzmadim echad l'sheni." They're clinging to one another.
And then
it wasn't following. It wasn't walking after. It was like literally grabbing hold and attaching yourself to it.
Right. And there's another word which you're well acquainted with, which is Levi.
Okay.
Now, what does that mean?
Well, the word Levi is from the word Laval, Lehit Lavot, which means to walk with or to accompany someone.
Okay, so there's a company, whereas this one is to cling to, and whereas the one that we mentioned in Joshua chapter 22, verse 5, is to glue to. That's interesting. I just find that interesting. Anyhow, but that's it's Numbers chapter 25, where this terrible thing happens in Baal Peor, and this is Pinchas's time to shine, and he thrusts.
He thrusts
the man of Israel and the woman of Moab through their body, and so the plague stopped. But yes, you're saying.
No, so what I'm saying, he also mentions the case of Achan, the son of Zerach. And they're also mentioning the fact that, you know, they're basically bringing up cases that other people died for someone else's sin. So they're basically saying, you want to bring death upon us.
That's right. And so he's reminding them, and he's saying, well, before we get that, I'll keep reading, because I think this is a brilliant speech from him. And he is bringing up these examples. And he says in verse 18 of Joshua 22, but that you must turn away this day from following the Lord, and it shall be that if you rebel today against the Lord, that tomorrow he will be angry with the whole congregation of Israel. Nevertheless, and he goes on about that, and as you say, he brings up the example of Achan, the son of Zerah, and because he knows that they remember about 36 men died in battle because of the sin of one man, that all of Israel had to suffer that loss. And then the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh answered and said to the heads of the divisions of Israel, Yehovah Elohim of God. Now, can you just tell me, verse 22, what does it read in Hebrew?
Well, it's actually a formula of an oath together with a... It's basically a type of oath with a negating meaning. So it says El, which means God, and then Elohim, which means, well, it's interesting how they use it. So it says El Elohim Adonai, El Elohim Adonai. So basically emphasizing that God is God, and there's no one else besides him. Mm-hmm. And this formula really leads into a negation here, and we basically says, no, no, no. It's like saying, like, no, 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 as God lives, we didn't do this.
Sure, sure. And they really, and they do. And so in their defense, they say, if it is in rebellion, or if in treachery against Yehovah, do not save us this day. If we have built ourselves an altar to turn from following Yehovah, or if... to offer on it burnt offerings and grain offerings and to offer peace offerings on it, let Yehovah himself require an account. But, in fact, we have done this, we have done it for fear, for a reason, saying, in time to come, your descendants may speak to our descendants, saying, what have you to do with Yehovah Elohim of Israel? For Yehovah has made the Jordan a border between you and us, you children of Reuben and children of Gad. You have no part in Yehovah. So the descendants... would make our descendants cease fearing Yehovah. Therefore, we said, let us now prepare to build ourselves an altar, not for burnt offerings or for sacrifice, but that it may be a witness between you and us in our generations after us. What were they thinking? How was it a witness?
Well, witness basically said, because it's there. They probably built an altar based on the specifications of the Torah, and also built something that looked like an altar that they use in the tabernacle, and together with all the rules of the other things. So basically, you know, when you have, you have to remember something, that the moment you live in two different areas, you have to remember dialect changes, clothing change, the influence of other societies change the groups. And basically what they were worried about is like, we're another Semitic group that lives in this area. And then your children are going to turn around to us and say, well, you might look like us, but you're not us. You know, some kind of zealous behavior, like, you're not Israelites, you're not part of the big group, therefore you're something else. And they're basically saying, you know, we want to put some kind of a marker that will make sure that this is something which we can identify as part of our practice. And what's a better way if not taking something which is one of the most central things, which is the shape of the altar, because the altar is kind of as a symbol. The tabernacle is a symbol. I mean, they say that in the desert they found these symbols of something on wheels, which they say represented the transporting tabernacle. And they actually said the symbols of the tabernacle were always very, very powerful Jewish symbols. So this probably is related as well, that they're basically saying, we're going to take something which is very, very symbolic to us as a nation, and we're going to build a big one so everyone can see it. No one can argue it's not there. And it will be used as a symbol of joining us together because we're on the other side of the river.
Right, right. Now, the question is, do we know where it is?
But by the way, well, we don't. I've tried to figure out if someone's found it, and no one's discovered it. There's no traces of it, which is kind of a shame because, you know, the foundations might be somewhere out there, and people have been just walked over it, and it's never been discovered, but the foundations might still be out there. You never know. Mm-hmm. And you have to remember, this was probably left out in the open, and in time, things start. Gravity does its thing, and it starts pulling things down. And it might be a pile of rubble now. We don't know.
Sure.
And also, I don't think that anyone's really interested in finding it. I mean, again, after all, it's in Jordan, so the Jordanians, I don't think, are very enthusiastic of discovering where it is. Right.
Fair enough. And so
you know what it means.
Oh yeah,
they have no right to the area, and they have to leave.
Can't have that. So they made a replica of the altar of Yehovah, which our fathers made, not for burnt offerings, nor for sacrifices, but it is a witness between you and us. And far be it from us that we should rebel against Yehovah and turn from following Yehovah this day to build an altar for burnt offerings and grain offerings, for sacrifices beside the altar of Yehovah Elohim, which is before his tabernacle. So they had it all understood. It was all good. And when Pinchas, the priest, and the rulers of the congregation, the heads of the divisions of Israel, who were with him, heard the words of the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and the children of Manasseh, they spoke, it pleased them. They were good. They were like, okay, so all right, so we're happy. And so they say, this day we perceive that Yehovah is among us because you have not committed this treachery against Yehovah, and now you have delivered the children of Israel out of the hand of the Lord. And so off they go. They go back, they explain it to everyone, and everyone goes, oh my goodness, that was close, but we're happy with that. And it remains as... And what did they call it? What was verse 34? What did they name the altar?
They actually called it. They actually called it Ed. Name of the altar was just mean witness.
Witness.
And why was it called witness? And they explained before he does a witness in between us as the tribes that Adonai is God.
Mm.
So that's the whole idea here.
Mm.
And it was called witness. It was called Ed. Oh look, it's Ed.
Ed, there you go. Nice.
And we actually have another very similar case like that for when Jacob and Laban, when they separated, so they built this heap of rocks and they called it Galed.
Oh, that's true.
Which is the heap, which is an ed, the heap of witness, heap which is witness, and Laban calls it in Aramaic Yagal Sahadutha, which Sahad is basically an Aramaic word which means witness. So Yagal is again the heap which is a witness, and it's interesting. And this is also, it was also put as a border, but that was different. It was like, you may not cross beyond this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also very interesting that they use this. It would be interesting if we do a research on these things, if all these types of things were called witness as well in different places.
And you know what? That's a really good point. And one of the things that I thought of, Yoel, when I was reading this, and this is a little bit off the topic, I suppose, but when I was reading this, I thought, you know, this, and I'm sure I'm guilty of this, and I'm just thinking out loud, but there's often times where we see people doing something and we think, oh, for sure, that can't be right. They shouldn't be doing that. At least they shouldn't be doing it that way. There's something that is clearly against the word, as far as I understand, and yet, man, I think they're going to get themselves into, they're going to fall out of the blessing of Yehovah. They're being disobedient. And it's not always the case. I mean, here are Pinchas and the 10 rulers, and they're absolutely convinced, you guys are doing the wrong thing. We're about to go to war with you. What do you have to say for yourselves? You better make it good. And but they offered their explanation, and they were happy with that. They were totally unaware that there could have been an explanation. But lo and behold, it turns out to be all good.
Mm-hmm. And that's what something. I mean, again, here it's on a national level, but when it comes to your neighbor or whatever it is, first of all, the first approach should be, why are you doing this, and have a discussion with them instead of like immediately attacking, like some people do.
Mm-hmm.
We have a saying: always judge your friend to righteousness. To the palm of righteousness, because mm-hmm. if a kaf is like a palm or a spoon, so we're talking about the spoons of the weight. Mm-hmm. But our idea is always when you see someone doing something which is peculiar, always think of them as being righteous, unless you discover that something else.
So it's basically like saying they're innocent until proven guilty. So start with a conversation.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, verse chapter 23. Now, Yoel, I don't think that I'm going to be able to do this without reading it all because it's pretty cool.
No, we can't read it all because we're trying to keep this in a certain frame. No, but the whole idea is also in chapter 23 and 24 is really a repeat of what happens in the end of the book of Deuteronomy. And there's a lot of language, again, as I pointed out, repeats itself over and over again in the book of Deuteronomy, which also appears here in the book of Exodus. It's paraphrasing, sorry, book of Joshua. It paraphrases the book of Deuteronomy every once in a while. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that we can read the whole thing, but the basic idea is...
I strongly encourage everybody to read both these final chapters, every single word, because it's just gold all the way through. But what about verse 6?
But let's look at a few parallels. Okay. We have, for example, in verse 2, he calls all the elders and the heads of Israel and the judges and the police, quote-unquote police, basically the people who you know, keep their eye open. It's kind of like the police. The word shotel became police today in Israel. And he does the same thing. Moses does the same thing with the elders. He calls over the elders and everyone. He talks to them.
Right.
And you wanted verse 6. So what does he say in verse 6 as he reads?
Therefore, be very courageous to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, lest you turn aside from it to the right hand or to the left, unless you go among these nations, these who remain among you. You shall not make mention of the name of their gods, nor cause anyone to swear by them. You shall not serve them, nor bow down to them, but you shall hold fast to Jehovah. Here's hold fast again. Hold fast to Jehovah your Elohim, as you have done to this day.
Yeah. So this is all repeat from the area of the beginning of Deuteronomy, like Deuteronomy 6, and places like that.
Mm. But I love the way it says here, for Jehovah has driven them out from before you, great and strong nations, but as for you, no one has been able to stand against you to this day. One man of you shall chase a thousand, for Jehovah, your Elohim, is he who fights for you as he promised. Therefore, take careful heed. And he goes on again. And there's a lot of that repetition of, listen, guys, do it properly. Behave yourselves. Do according to what you've said and be obedient.
And he also says, for example, in verse 14, he says, I'm about to die, etc. And he says to them, he says at the end, nothing that God has promised has fallen. Basically, he's fulfilled in the entire promise. And then she goes over this whole thing. For example, almost to the literal meaning of things. For example, it says that he sent the wasp to attack them, and it says that happened here in the book of Joshua, and they conquered the land. But there's an interesting problem here. For one hand, God did everything from his end. But the Israelites left these pockets of Canaanites, and that leads, as I pointed out last time, that leads into the book of Judges, which we'll hopefully start dealing with next week.
Yeah,
but he repeats a lot of things with the book of Deuteronomy. You read Deuteronomy, you read this chapter, and it's a repeat. He is given like a summed up speech of the huge speech that Moses gave. Yes. He gives like a summing up of the speech that Moses gave.
Right.
He literally uses the same language. I'm reading this in Hebrew, and he just uses the same language. You know, for example, the last verse here in the chapter literally is a repeat of Deuteronomy 11. He uses the exact same words.
It says, therefore it shall come to pass that as all the good things have come upon you, which Jehovah Elohim promised you, so Jehovah will bring upon you all harmful things until he has destroyed you from this good land which Jehovah your Elohim has given you, when you have transgressed the covenant of Jehovah your Elohim, which he has commanded you, you've gone and served other gods and bowed down to them, then the anger of Jehovah will burn against you, and you shall perish quickly from the good land which he has given you.
That's Deuteronomy 11, just to be very blunt. It's a repeat of Deuteronomy 11.
And so it's just a reminder that it's clearly conditional, right?
Yeah, it's clearly conditional. And he's basically saying he's done all of this stuff, but beware. Don't play around with it. Mm. That's part number one again. But again, there's an interesting thing that happens every time a great leader, we're talking about really the massive leaders, we're talking about Moses, Joshua, and then the only real person we have anything similar to this is Samuel. Mm-hmm. They give this final speech before they die, and they more or less all say the same things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's conditional. There's a condition here. You don't do whatever you want. You might be God's favorite son, but being his son comes with certain responsibilities. There's a covenant here. He loves you as a son, but there's a covenant. There's an agreement here. And you have to keep to that agreement. But he also says, besides the agreement of Mount Sinai, there's also love to Abraham. This is where he repeats it as well. When he talks about In Leviticus, he talks about the warning, but he says even in the land of the exile will not forsake them. So there's also love of Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
So you see from all these things put together, yes, there's a covenant, yes, there's transgression, yes, we can be punished, but there's always this but here. And it actually also appears in the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah also, I think it's in chapter 2, he talks about the different things that can happen, but then he also points out, I think in the beginning of chapter 2, he points out this whole thing that God still loves the people of Israel no matter what happens.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't completely forsake, but he can forsake for the sake of punishing.
Yes, that's right. So I've got to highlight some verses in chapter 24, but you're absolutely right. And you know what it reminds me of? And I don't know if it's the same with American gridiron, but here in Australia...
American what?
They have gridiron, right? That's like American football.
Whatever. As I keep on pointing out, I'm not an American, so I don't know.
So I don't know if it's the same with rugby union. I mean, that's big in England, but in rugby league here in Australia, right? It's a football game, and these are the rules of the game. And
I know what rugby is.
There it is, and both teams will abide by the rules. And we had a fairly major game just recently. And what happens is if they go outside of the rules and do something defiantly rebellious, then guess what, Yoel? They get sent off for a period of time. You know where they go?
Where they go?
It's called the sin bin.
The sin bin?
To this day, it is referred to as the sin bin. It's like, okay, you've gone, not only have you gone outside the rules, you've done something defiantly, and we're sending you off to the sin bin for 10 minutes. And that's just what it's known as. And really, is this not what it's saying here? Obey your God. Do what he says. If you are defiant and against that, you're going to the sin bin. You're going off the field. The field is the land, and you're getting off for a period of time. And it's that simple. Sin bin. There you go.
Yes. So now we have chapter 24, which is the last chapter in the book of Joshua.
The last chapter.
And he also, again, he highlights... Joshua then collects all the tribes. He first of all speaks with the elders and all the official people, and now collects the entire people of Israel. And they actually stand before the Elohim. They come probably to Shiloh or something like that. Mm-hmm. Though it doesn't actually look like they actually were in Shechem, which is kind of interesting. And there's a whole thing here that happens, which is really fascinating. We don't really know 100% what the thing was, but there's a few details here which are very strange. And he just gives, again, a summary of everything that's happened from basically Abraham all the way to that very point that they were standing there in front of Joshua. And he highlights all these things. He talks about the Exodus. He talks about the parting of the sea. And he talks about Bilam, who came to curse the people of Israel. And he talks about things that most of them did see, because he talks about crossing the Jordan River, conquering Jericho. And he repeats again language here from Deuteronomy, a land which you've not worked for, cities which you do not build, and you sit in them, and vineyards and orchards which you do not plant. And he basically says,
I want to ask you a favor. This is verse 14 through to verse 14 and 15. Would you please, just for me, would you read those two verses in Hebrew first?
Okay. So it says, "Ve'ata yireu et Adonai ve'ivdu oto betamim ve'emet ve'hasiru et Elohim asher avedu avotechem be'ever ha'nahar uve'mitzrayim ve'ivdu et Adonai ve'imra be'einichem la'avo et Adonai b'charu lachem hayom et mita avdun im et Elohim asher avedu avotechem asher me'ever ha'nahar." And I stop there for a second, because there's Kriyan Ktiv here. There's be'ever and me'ever, and Kriyan Ktiv is a situation where there were probably two traditions of how they wrote something. And they put one tradition inside the text and then another tradition in the margin. Read about this some other time. So it reads, "Asher me'ever ha'nahar, v'im et Elohei ha'emori asher atem yoshevim ba'artzam v'anochi uveti na'avo et Adonai." He's given actually three options here.
Walk us through it.
He basically says, and now, ve'ata is a temporal modifier. Now, make a decision. He's telling them, you have a choice to make. Now, I'm about to die. I don't know who's going to come after me. And we actually see that when Joshua dies, it goes into this period of chaos. He says to him, now fear the Lord and follow him or worship him betamim uvemet, with full heartness, and or tamim is from the word tam, which means with no blemish and with truth. And remove the gods which your ancestors worshipped on the other side of the river and in Egypt, and worship the Lord. And if it's bad in your eyes or not sufficient in your eyes to worship the Lord, choose to for yourselves who you're going to be worship, who you worship, the gods which your ancestors worshipped on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites, because the Amori sometimes is used just to express the Canaanites, which you sit in their land, and I and my house, or basically I and my family, will worship the Lord.
Amen.
He's going to basically give them three options, but he says, I don't care what you're going to be doing. I know what my family is going to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the people just answer, and they say, we're not going to leave. We're not going to leave our God. We're not going to go worship anyone else.
Mm. I've got, far be it from us. I've got that we should forsake Jehovah to serve other gods. For Jehovah, and it goes on to, it pretty much echoes to him what he has said, everything that God has done for them. And but this is interesting, verse 19, but Joshua said to the people, you cannot serve the Lord, for he is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgression nor your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, then he will turn and do you harm and consume you after he has done you good. And the people said to Joshua, no, but we will serve Jehovah.
It's kind of a rhetorical argument, I would say. Yeah. It's like, no, there's no way you're doing it. No, we can. He's kind of like probably trying to corner them to full-heartedly accept it. But it's a funny way how he puts it.
It is kind of funny because he says, now, this is what you must do. As for me, I'm going to do this. And they go, oh, we will definitely do that. And he says, no, you won't. You can't. You're not going to do it. They say, yeah, we will. We will do it. We will.
He's trying to squeeze it out of them, basically. He's like,
he's squeezing it out of them. And in verse 22, so Joshua said to the people, you're witnesses against yourselves that you have chosen Jehovah for yourselves to serve him. And they said, we are witnesses. And so he's really painted them into the corner and said, look, there's no other way. You cannot interpret what we have just done any other way. This in black and white is what you've said, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of interesting. I'm looking at one of the commentators and he's saying, it looks as if Joshua is giving them options, but there's no real options here. He's being kind of like, he's being a bit sarcastic, and he's like saying, well, you have options here we don't really have. And these are your options, which are just completely fictitious.
Yeah.
And I don't really believe you're able to do this. And they're saying, oh, no, of course we can. Of course we can. He's trying to he can try to say, look at it as if he's being a bit funny about it, but he's not being funny. He's being very, very serious. So it's kind of an emphatic way. He's basically overemphasizing things to make the point.
Mm.
So it's not just he's using the language deliberately, not squeezing out of them. He's being emphatic in a slightly weird way.
So that they are protesting to him. They're protesting to him, and he draws it out of them, and they protest to him, no, he will do it. And he achieves that.
Yes, exactly. And then he does something very, very interesting. He writes this down in a thing that they call Besefer Torat Elohim, the book of the law of God.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like, he's sitting down, he's writing down this new agreement. And Moses does the exact same thing. Moses sits down and writes a song. And he's told to teach the people of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Here, Joshua is doing the exact same thing. He's writing down this agreement. Now, what is this Sefer Torat Elohim? We don't really know. So some scholars wanted to claim, oh, it's the Torah scroll. He really studied the Torah scroll, etc. But it could be that this was another book that they called Sefer Torat Elohim. Sure. But I once saw this opinion that said, oh, he wrote this down on another piece of parchment, whatever it was, and he placed it together with the original Torah scroll that Moses wrote. So there's supposed to be a Torah scroll Moses wrote, and then an extra piece of parchment, which was a renewal of agreement before he dies.
Mm-hmm.
So there's different opinions what happens here, but then we have another thing that happens. So he cuts a covenant, and the whole issue of cutting a covenant, there's a whole explanation about it, but it always appears as lichot brit, karat brit. So it's cutting something, and then there's a covenant. There were different ways of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
They used to cut animals, used to cut themselves. There's a whole bunch of stuff. In the Bible, we don't have the whole thing cutting yourself, but we have the thing of cutting an animal.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very, very ancient. This dates back to a very, very early period in human history. But I actually found a document. It was actually given to me. The document was given to me, Enrico Cortez, because we're doing this whole research on covenants.
Mm.
And one of the documents I pulled out that he gave me has actually an explanation. Someone, one of the partners in this document, says, if I break this covenant, may this happen to me, basically pointing out to the call of that animal. So basically saying, if we break the oath, we will be carved into two as well, basically die. But then he takes a large rock and he lifts it up and he puts it under an Allah, which is It's not Elah, which means it's not a tree. Let me actually look up what the word Elah means.
In the English, I've got an oak tree. He puts it under an oak.
So that's what I always thought it meant, and it probably does mean that. But the problem is that it says Allah, not Elah. The word Elah is usually an oak tree. Hmm.
It makes me think of when Jacob instructed.
Oh, but by the way, in verse 25, it says that Joshua cut the covenant and he put a law and judgment in Shechem, which is kind of weird. What are they exactly doing? So I thought maybe they actually went to the original altar, which they built when they entered on Mount Eival. But it doesn't mention Eival, which is kind of strange. But we already established the tabernacle was in Shiloh, and that's usually before the God. So maybe Shechem was like the capital for the time. That's where he sat. This was the capital of the king. It's pretty confusing. This entire section is very, very confusing. But let me look up the word Elah for a second, because I'm just wondering, what is this whole thing of putting under a tree?
Yeah, I want to know, because I do recall that when they ridded Jacob's family, when they ridded themselves of foreign gods, if I remember correctly, didn't he bury them under the oak tree?
So he buried under an oak tree, and they actually pointed that out as well, some of the commentators. But the whole thing is very strange, because he does the covenant in Shechem, and then he writes down the words and put in the book of the law of God, and then he takes a large rock, he lifts it up as a symbol of the covenant, and then it's under some tree in the temple of God, and some people say, oh, that's a temple in Shiloh.
Because I've got by, it was by, so it says under the oak tree that was by the sanctuary of the Lord. Have you got in the temple of God, in the sanctuary of?
So the preposition here is bemikdash, which means in the proximity of the temple or in the temple itself. But it can be bamikdash or bemikdash, but it's not bamikdash, which becomes the temple. It's bemikdash in a temple.
Okay.
So this whole thing is this entire section is really peculiar, and it's not clear exactly it's clear who's doing what, but where are they doing it? And this is what's very, very strange. So this can be a some kind of tree somewhere else that has some kind of historical significance, but it's a tree near the temple of God. Why do we have a tree near the temple of God?
It's mysterious. What is this?
The whole thing is mysterious. I've read several researchers on this, and no one knows exactly what happened.
Wow.
Really, it's one of the most peculiar verses that you can bump into in the Bible, because it's quoting some historical fact without its historical context.
Yeah.
So it's just not clear.
That's how it seems. Okay. All right. Well, I guess that's just something we have to swallow. And so then the people departed, each to his own inheritance. Now, here's the sad part of the story, Yoel.
Mm-hmm.
From verse 29, it says, "Now it came to pass after these things that Yehoshua ben Nun, the servant of Jehovah, died, being 110 years old, and they buried him within the border of his inheritance at Timnath." Is that right? Timnath-Serah?
Timnath-Serah.
Okay. Which is in the mountains of Ephraim on the north side of Mount Gash. Israel served Jehovah all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had known all the works of Jehovah which he had done for Israel. The bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel had brought up out of Egypt, they buried at Shechem. Now, before I go on, I'll tell you what, I'll finish this. I want to ask you a question about that. In the plot of the ground which Jacob had bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver, and which had become an inheritance of the children of Joseph, and Eleazar, the son of Aaron, died, they buried him in a hill belonging to Pinchas, his son, which was given to him in the mountains of Ephraim. And that's how it ends. Now, do we have, are we sure we have tombs for these men? Are there tombs for these men today?
So there are places that people identify as your tombs. There's a tomb of Joshua, there's a tomb of Eleazar, there's a tomb of Itamar, his brother, there's a tomb of Pinchas, there's a tomb for almost everyone. The question is, are these tombs real?
Mm.
The history of a lot of these tombs is that some of them are well documented hundreds of years backwards into the history of this area. And a lot of places were treated very well and were respected by the Arab inhabitants. And you have to remember, there were always Jews here, so there's always some kind of a tradition. And the Arabs just preserved a lot of the names. The only issue is that there are places that it's highly questionable if these are really tombs of people that which appear in the Bible. Sometimes it can be cases this is a tomb of some sheikh or something. Right. So it's not 100% clear. Mm-hmm. The one of the only tombs that we can actually say, there's very few tombs that we can actually say 100% this is the original tomb, are the tomb of the patriarchs and the matriarchs in Hebron.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph's tomb mm-hmm. is one of the only ones that we can actually say is probably it.
Mm-hmm.
And besides that, everything is speculation. But these are the only two that we can actually put down. Maybe there's a few more. It's not coming to mind at the moment. But these are the only two that we can actually say, this is it.
Because so the tomb known as Eleazar's tomb today is speculation. It's we're not entirely sure.
If you ask a religious Orthodox Jew if it's the tomb of Eleazar, Tamar, whatever, they'll say, oh, of course it is. But when you look into depth into this, it might be it might not be it. But let me ask a very simple question.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we even interested in going to tombs?
That's a good question.
I've been asking this question for years already.
I don't know, but there's always there, and particularly Joseph's tomb. Just recently, there was a scuttle there where mm-hmm. they were they had to stay inside for a time because there was some serious rock throwing going on outside.
Yeah, I mean, basically since September, October of 2000. There used to be. I actually went to that yeshiva before. I mean, I've been in Joseph's tomb as well mm-hmm. Years ago, and it's first of all, if you ever look at it, it's a tiny little structure, on the outskirts of really the southern side of Nablus. It's really part of the open field, which is kind of interesting. It's a tomb which is part of the open field, Chakat HaSadeh,
mm-hmm.
and there used to be a rabbinic school there, a yeshiva. And they were expelled back in 2000, and have been persecuted for years already. I mean, one of the main characters that just got persecuted for writing a book that deals with has a section that deals about war and in what situations are you allowed to kill someone who you know basically during war? What situations mm-hmm. can you kill mm-hmm. a Gentile? And it's really more in dealing with you know Arabs and violent situations with Arabs. In what situations can you actually go and shoot the person to death or whatever it is? Mm-hmm. Basically dealing with, you know, you can't always, you know, it's not just always kill, kill, kill. It's sometimes mm-hmm. you have to use your head. And, but part of the whole concept here is that they were expelled from a piece of property was bought by our ancestors, by a bunch of Arabs who are now, by the way, turning over to the UN and saying, help us from the atrocities of the settlers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And every once in a while they open fire, they attack, the Nablus is a center of terrorism. Unlike mm-hmm. what the PA tries to push, it's a center of terrorism. And believe me, I know this because I've been there
mm-hmm.
and I know what goes on there. And you have terrorists who walk in the street openly, walk around with weapons and everything. It's all in the open.
Mm.
And that's how safe they feel there. So I don't know whether this whole thing will turn into the UN. It's just another PA stunt.
Mm.
But
some of the tombs are located in some of these hotspots, right?
Most of the tombs are set in the hotspots. And this is where every time they want to go there, they have to have the military to open up a pathway. And they do it several hours before just to make sure there's no side road bombs and road bombs.
So the question
like
remains.
That.
The question remains then, as you brought up, why do we want to go to these tombs? Why are we driven to go?
You want an entire lesson about the history of this subject?
Well, let's put it in a nutshell. Why do most Jews go to the tombs?
So I don't know if it's most Jews, but it's become a very cultic thing based on Kabbalistic teachings. It was actually the Arizal, Rabbi Luria,
mm-hmm.
Was considered to be one of the biggest Kabbalists ever, who pointed out this whole thing going to tombs. And there's this entry in a Midrash that says, it's kind of interesting, when the 12 spies entered the land, it says in a single form, and he went to Hebron. Now, you can claim that this is a collective single, but it can also be that one of them actually went. So there's this entry in one of the Midrashim that says that it was Kalev who went to the tomb of the patriarchs to pray for the sin, to pray over the sins of the 10 spies. Mm-hmm. Now, that might be true. It might be possible a truth because they probably knew the notion of what's going to happen while they were already traveling inside the land. Kalev got the idea. But as a single person from a unit that's trying to protect itself, I don't see anyone breaking off and moving. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, Hebron was a city of giants, and we see that. We're going to see that also in the Book of Judges. So mm-hmm. it's very possible, it's extremely possible that I'm using really bad English today. It's probable that they all went into collective he. But what we see in this Midrash is that there's this concept of going to tombs to pray. Now, as we all know, tombs are unclean. If you touch a tomb, you become unclean. Mm. And there's actually an entry in the Talmud that says a person or people who pray at tombs are suspected dealing with witchcraft. Mm. So I think it's just an issue. Really, the original issue is the tomb of the ancestors had to do with someone's clinging to his heritage, and that's how the whole idea of visiting your ancestors' tombs as a sign of respect and an emotional thing, like when people go to the tomb. Sure. So it wasn't worship of the dead spirit, but it's become really ridiculous today where we have tombs today which are like highly respected places. This is an unclean place. Mm. So there's actually a lot of people today which are fighting this, including me. I've been talking in public about this. But today, what's very, very important with this issue, and this is why I'm not really attacking this in full strength, is because we're in war with the Arabs. Who owns what? And if we have these little sections inside Arab territory, we say this is ours, and the military and the government recognize it being ours. That's an achievement. So I don't really mind if they're going to the tomb. There's another, as we said, there's one side, there's several sides to one situation, to one thing. There's always several sides. And the side here is that we have to understand that there's a political war going on here. So I'm not openly attacking this like really full force, but I do explain the, I always go around to explain the people this. You have to remember, this is a tomb and this is an unclean place, and don't worship in this place, but come and visit. Because it's important that we put our foot down and say, this is ours.
Very good point. Excellent point. I'm glad you made that. We should leave it there. But it ends, of course, as I said, it ends with the death of Joshua and Eleazar. It's a sad way to end, but it does set the scene, of course, with the next book, which is the Book of Judges, which we're going to be getting into next week. So thank you, Yoel Ben Shlomo. His Facebook page, once again, Hebrew in Israel. And there's a link on the sidebar, the right-hand sidebar of truth2u.org, truth2u.org. Go to the Facebook page, like it, interact with the information and with others. And if you would like Hebrew lessons from this very knowledgeable man, my goodness, you can inquire by emailing hebrewinisrael@gmail.com, hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. And if these programs have been a blessing to you, dear listeners, you can also show your support by donating at truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. So I'm looking forward to getting into Judges, Yoel. Thank you again for your time.
You're welcome. Judges is going to be very, very interesting because there's a lot more historical information there. There's a lot of things to pick out there. And we probably will have to take the Book of Judges slowly.
It's a wild, very, very wild ride. It's a wild ride. So we're going to go through that one a little bit slower. But until then, dear listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.